told everybody it was going to be the next billion-dollar company. And I was so convinced about it that I told myself, I'm going to do this. And I quit my job and I started it. And then 2 weeks in, I was like, oh, shit. Nobody wants this. I mean, literally nobody would sign up for the app. But I was kind of like, dang, like, everyone will think I'm a loser if I go back to Google with my tail between my legs having failed like this. So I have to keep going.
How close were you to quitting?
I spent $20,000 on Meta, but then from those 5,000 leads, only 1% converted. And when I look behind the scenes, I realize that a lot of my traffic has jumped. It's funny because 99% of every email and every talk and every conversation I had was worthless. Only one in 100 things really taught me something that actually moved me closer to finding success.
Imagine joining a Zoom call with someone you never met, but instantly knowing who the person is, their background, mutual connections, and an icebreaker. That's the world Max Greenwald and the team from Warmly set out to build, to make everyday business meetings an opportunity for high-value relationship opportunities. Max, a Forbes 30 Under 30 honoree, co-founded Warmly after years at Google, seeing and experiencing how important relationships are in business success, and especially realizing how technology can help bridging the gap. Today, Warmly's AI-powered meeting intelligence platform gives professionals insights on the people they're talking to, helps sales teams close deals faster, and leaders build stronger networks. In this episode, moderated by serial founder and angel investor Mike Malko, Max pulls back the curtain and gives hands-on advice and also real insights in building Warmly. From scrappy startup experiments to raising millions in funding, from building a product in a crowded SaaS landscape to finding the exact problem worth solving. You'll hear how Max approaches founder decision-making, why timing in the market matters more than most people think, and the hard lessons he learned about team culture, product focus, and the mental game of entrepreneurship. If you've ever wondered how you can take a simple idea and build a venture-backed company out of it, which product is actually used, you're going to get a masterclass today. You're listening to Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch. And now, shine light for Mike Malko and Max Greenwald talking about building Warmly.
Hey, Max, how are you?
Mike, good to see you. I'm doing well.
It's good to see you. Why don't you, like, just to start, tell us a little bit about yourself, just like 30-second, one-minute intro of who are you, what are you doing?
Yeah, so my name is Max Greenwald. I'm the CEO and founder of Warmly.ai, which builds AI sales and marketing agents to help you get more warm leads. Warm leads. And I've been building this business for about 6 years now. And after a couple of years living in Europe, I've just moved to San Francisco to build our first office ever.
Oh, wow. Tell me more about that. How many employees do you have?
So we have 60 employees globally, and there's probably about 30 in the US. And then the SF office to start will probably be about 8 or 9. We'd love to have folks move in person with us to SF, but it is difficult being a remote first company. But since we've been growing a lot, we're now just crossing 5 million of ARR. We are really excited to kind of start a physical in-person presence. We never thought we'd do it, being a kind of COVID era company. I mean, the first summer of the company was in Hawaii on the beach during Y Combinator. And so, you know, we've been traveling around for a long time. And now it's time to build roots and see if we can help scale this thing faster by having an in-person culture too.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about that. Like, will all co-founders be in San Francisco then, or will you still be split, or how does that work?
Yep. So our head of engineering and one co-founder was already in San Francisco, and then two of our remaining co-founders, myself included, moved to San Francisco. And so we're kind of developing the core of leadership and in one place. But at least for now, are totally fine with the rest of our folks being remote across the US and the world. I mean, we have 20 in North Macedonia, 10 in Brazil, 5 in Pakistan, 4 in Philippines, 3 in Israel. So we're all over the place.
Interesting. How do you manage that? I mean, it's one of the questions like everyone's talking about, right? How do you work with a remote workforce? Are there like any specific things that have worked really well for you?
Well, first I'll say I need to admit that it's a 10 to 15% haircut on the success of the company. I think objectively in all remote culture, the benefit being smart talent anywhere, more affordable talent anywhere, and the drawback being lack of good communication and lack of ability to, I think, just like drive fast alignment leads to, I think, about a 10 to 15% drop in company quality. But it comes, you know, maybe it's worth it. Maybe you started off that way, or maybe you didn't know. And that's kind of our company, which is like, we didn't know for better or for worse. We just were in COVID and went remote to start and kept it that way. So given the fact that I do believe today, now 5.5 or 6 years in, it is a slight drop in the success, the sort of ability for the company to be successful, or just like an outcome for the company. We've obviously done the best we can to try to make up for that deficit and make a really strong remote culture. One of the things we tried in the deep depths of COVID was a virtual office. And so like a Lego video game, you could use your arrow keys and walk up to people and jump into group chats and all that kind of stuff.
Which one did you use? Did you use Gather or?
Gather, exactly. Okay, yeah, Gather, nice. Yeah. And it failed. I mean, it was a cute idea, but it wasn't really sticky. I think at the end of the day, we live, breathe, and eat Slack. And so the main things that have worked for us are very clear Slack guidelines as to what you can and can't post and how you use things like snoozing so that you're aware of people's time zones, how to use urgency around saying this is urgent, this is important, this can be done next week, stuff like that. And then we really make use of huddles. So it's very encouraged to be huddling people all day long. So not even necessarily to get something done, but even just let's work side by side and let's just be on audio together if we need to.
How well do huddles work for you? Because like huddles are one of the few things where like the reliability for me in terms of like which mic it picks or there's always something wrong with my huddles, but I don't know if I'm the like just the like the,
no,
the person that's wrong
here. Throughout the company, there's always a couple of people who struggle with like huddles. It must be some poor reliability within that feature, but whatever. It's good enough. And I think for my company, it works 97% of the time. The other thing that I think you could normalize is you oftentimes, if you see coworkers in a huddle, you don't want to join them because sort of you're like, oh, they're talking. But if you think about a normal office, if I see you talking to somebody else, I'm just going to barge in and come up to you and get involved. And I think we also like to encourage that. They're saying, you know what, just join in. They'll kick you out if they don't want to talk to you, but like, you know, get on in to kind of drive the just to make sure you're successful. And so we've normalized that. One interesting exception, which maybe could make remote work better, is that if you're always in person, you find that your sales and CS team will just interrupt your engineering team all the time. And so now we have sort of like Slack guidelines of like engineers need deep work. Don't interrupt them. Let them crush code. And then, you know, maybe leave huddling to the top of the hour or look at their schedule to see when they're next in a meeting and then huddle them 5 minutes before, 5 minutes after.
That is a very, very important point. Like we were like a pre-COVID in person during COVID remote and then mostly in person company again, like basically forced to just like make changes, right? As many companies have been forced to during COVID. And one of the main things that we always try to protect is engineering focus time because it's such a valuable resource, right? If you want to build great software. So one of the constant conversations my co-founder, who was the CTO, and me, the CEO, were always having is, how can we ensure to protect engineering focus time, but at the same time still get this like vibrant communication flowing? Because we believe that like better product is being built if the people actually talk to each other. And so yeah, it's this constant back and forth. It doesn't matter whether it's like remote, in person, like it's always important. One thing that you said earlier is one of the things that I always found basically almost the most impressive about your journey at Warmly, and I include your co-founders in that, is you've been on it for a long time, right? If you literally just look at your metrics right now, like 5 million ARR, things are going up. I see you post these like charts every now and then and everything looks pretty rosy, but it wasn't always like that, right? You had like a very, I just used the word rough beginning. You like repositioned a couple times. Tell us a little more about like the early days and then how you persisted through all this adversity to then, for now at least, come out on top.
Yeah, well, it may look rosy, but man, there's hardship everywhere and every business is a slog. So yeah, it's interesting because I didn't realize all of the problems and difficulties of business building when I set out to create this, which is my first startup. And if I knew everything that I knew now and going all the way back, and I was at my cushy job at Google, making pretty good money, not working that hard, I don't know if I would have taken that leap. And, you know, of course I would have, because what I know today in terms of hiring and firing and raising and losing and winning and SaaS contracts and mid-market and enterprise and just all sorts of great skills, I wouldn't trade that for the world. But I never would have thought that it would have taken us 3 years to start to find the semblance of product market fit. And it's funny because 99% of every email and every talk and every conversation I had was worthless, which is like crazy. It's sort of like only 1 in 100 things really taught me something that actually moved me closer to finding success. And so, yeah, we pivoted 6 times before we found product market fit over 3 years. I think I'm pretty decent at fundraising, which is why I got lucky in that we basically were able to raise enough money to keep going through those pivots. And that's the only reason that we were able to survive that long. Most founders kind of have to pivot a few times and then, you know, they run out of money or something. But yeah, I think it was a combination of perseverance, a combination of dumb luck, a combination of just sitting there long enough in our space to really deeply understand and recognizing that we were mercenaries. You know, the mercenary versus missionary kind of saying, right, where it's like there's two kinds of founders. There's the missionaries who want to just see one problem solved no matter what. And there's the mercenaries that drop into any space having zero knowledge of that space. And they're just going to try a bunch of things and see, you know, pivot around. And who cares? They just want to build a big business. My co-founders and I are mercenaries. And we were sort of dropped in, you know, to this world of sales and marketing technology, horizontal broadly. And we didn't know jack shit about sales and marketing people. I mean, I was such a fucking idiot because I came from Google, where at Google Maps, where I worked, there was no sales and marketing people. We had 1 billion, 2 billion users. It was like, why do you need sales and marketing? And so I didn't understand how difficult it was to be a SaaS salesperson or a SaaS marketing person. A glorious job nonetheless. I mean, a fun one for sure, but very difficult. And so it took me probably 2 years to deeply understand who these users are, what they do, and how I can serve them. And it was a benefit that I was an outsider because I was able to bring in this sort of idea of why can't we use technology? Why can't we use AI to solve a lot of this? But the downside was that I had to be there a long time before I was qualified to be able to slice through my space fast enough to be able to find product market fit and then launch from there.
Yeah, that reminds me a little bit of my sales experience at Stripe. When I worked at Stripe, I did like all kinds of different tasks. One of them was also like just direct sales because the team was very small back then when I was there, especially in Europe where I spent most of my time. And selling Stripe is a fundamentally different experience than selling most other products because Stripe is just so much better than most of the competitors' products, right? So like selling it felt more like it was actually helping them to implement it versus actually convincing them to sell it. And as you know very well, usually sales isn't that straightforward. And Google Maps is like an even better example where like you already had all the users, right? And then what are you using? I can use Apple Maps. I can use Google Maps. Maybe I use Waze. I don't know. But there's not that much like competition on the market. So things are a bit different. One other thing that I would like to dive a little deeper in is Let's start at the like rough times, like the really rough times early on. I mean, building a startup is always rough to some degree. And then we go to like the more successful times. How close were you to quitting back then? Like, was it ever a conversation that you had, or were you just like in terms of like the founding team, were you always just like believing to continue? Was it ever on the table? How did these conversations go after you just pivoted the 5th time and it still didn't work?
Maybe the closest we ever got to quitting was between pivot 5 and 6, when I told my co-founders, I only have one more big pivot left in me. And really at that point, it was just a function of like, we didn't, you know, we were diluted from the cap table. We had spent a good amount of money. You know, I would have kept starting more businesses, but I wanted to like start a fresh, clean cap table, new business. And that was the one that I worked out. So I'm very happy with that. I don't think I could have quit because I tied up so much of my ego and self-worth and my reputation into the success of the company. And so everyone around me in Silicon Valley back in 2020 was quitting their jobs to start a startup. It was like the cool thing to do. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a bit of a sheep just wanting to like follow what everyone else did and like try it myself because it seemed more glorious and cool than working for Google, which is like really sleepy. And so when I did it, I remember telling all my friends and family, I'm going to go start a startup. And then I had this great idea at the time. This was almost call it like pivot -1. It was like before I even got my co-founders together. And I thought this was the best idea in the whole fucking world. I was convinced. I was like, this is a $1 billion business. And it was not. It was the worst idea in the whole world. But I didn't know that at the time.
And what idea was it?
Oh, Mike, you're going to love this. It was Tinder.
I'm very excited. A Tinder.
It was Tinder for co-founders.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So the idea was, I want to start a business, but I can't find a co-founder. Help me out. And YC ended up coming out with like co-founder matching or whatever down the road. But it's not a business. I mean, the fundamental problem there from a psychology perspective is that in dating, you want to date somebody better than you. And men and women, assuming heterosexual couples, want different things. And so they can match. And there's like a band of overlap where you both feel like you're winning. But in matching to find a co-founder, you just want somebody smarter and better than you. And so it's very hard often to meet with someone and then go, yeah, they're smarter and better than me. And then why would they want to talk to you? Like they're on a hunt to find somebody better. And also learned that like the best co-founders are people you've known for a long time and you can trust. Yeah. It's such a big thing to start a company. So that went down the tube. But I, at the time, told everybody it was going to be the next $1 billion company. And I was so convinced about it that I told myself, I'm going to do this. And I quit my job and I started it. And then 2 weeks in, I was like, oh shit, like this is, nobody wants this. I mean, literally nobody would sign up for the app. And I think I spent $10,000 of my own money, you know, building the app through a friend. It was just so janky. And I remember that was a low for sure. But I was kind of like, dang, like everyone will think I'm a loser if I go back to Google with my tail between my legs having failed like this. So I have to keep going. So I think that was a low, but it definitely didn't mean that I was going to walk away.
Got it. Yeah. I think this is one of the issues that co-founders or like founders in general often have. Is that so much of their ego is being tied up in the success of the company, right? And that can be very good in the sense that you like persevere and just keep going, but it doesn't work out for everyone, right? Most startups fail. And then I think what you said earlier is what I always try to say as well. Well, if a company failed, then you just build the next one. If you're like a real entrepreneur at heart, then that's part of the journey, right? And perseverance is very important. And some people quit too early, but I definitely know some people who quit too late. And where it's like very obvious that they are just grinding on their like physical and mental health. And it would be better for everyone if they literally just quit and did something else. However, it's sometimes difficult. Like, who would have known that your sixth pivot actually works, right? I mean, ultimately, no one really knows. But let's talk about that a little bit. Like, what is the thing that you deliver warm leads that you, what you said earlier. By the way, I never made the connection between warm leads and Warmly until earlier today. But what was the actual pivot? So what are you building now? What is it that like finally made it work?
Yeah. So we've been playing around in the sales and marketing space for those main five pivots. And we were trying kind of like different go-to-market models and we were trying different wedges into the space. And throughout each pivot, we honestly learned a couple of key skills that kept us in the game and made it easier and better and faster for the next pivot. So I think that like there's only one graph that has to go up and to the right in your founding journey, and it's learning. And so if you take time on one axis and learning on the other, learning should be up and to the right. And so every pivot, even though revenue would spike up and down, even though, you know, product direction would spike up and down, user base would spike up and down, learning was always up and to the right. So broadly speaking, our first pivot, nobody wanted to buy or use. Second one, nobody wanted to buy it, but some people would use it. Third one, a lot of people wanted to use it, but nobody wanted to buy it. And along the way, as we were getting closer and closer, we were learning how to scrape LinkedIn at scale. We were learning how to build core infrastructure, how to use, you know, React and TypeScript. We were learning how to have customer interviews. We were learning how to have a customer advisory board. We were building mentors and advisors. We were learning how to make fast landing pages. We were learning how to buy data and clean that data. We were learning and building, forging relationships with people who would then become our customers down the road. And they would tell us, we like you, you're fun people, but like, we don't want to buy your stupid software. And I came back to them 2 years later. I was like, hopefully I'm still fun. Like, here's real software. And they're like, hell yeah. We were building our brand. We were building SEO. So we were compounding skills such that it was that much faster when we hit the ground. I mean, a lot of people will say to us, oh my God, you went 0 to 1 million in ARR in 1 year. Then you went 1 to 3.1 million the next year. You know, you guys are wizards. Like, you guys are going really fast. And I'd say, yeah, like, I'm very grateful and proud of it. But recognize that we had 3 years of zero, more or less, that taught us how to be like fifth time founders. And so when we were finally ready to kind of explode, we had all the pieces and the battle scars and the wounds and the tactics and the, you know, good lawyer, good marketer, bad salesperson, good engineer, bad engineer. I mean, every sort of role we had sort of worked out all the kinks. And I'll never forget this. My board member, James Currier at NFX, told me that he was giving me my seed round, and I was, of course, ecstatic. And he said, I'm giving you the seed round instead of your business, instead of you going to business school. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I'm going to give you this money, and you will burn every single cent of it, all my money, and I'm solely doing it so that you and your co-founders will learn. And I was like, yeah, but you want us to build a billion-dollar business, right? He's like, sure, but you're not smart enough to build a billion-dollar business yet. You need to cut your teeth in building several iterations and pivots and getting better and faster every time. So I'm paying for your startup business school, and then you're going to make me $1 billion. And I think that came out to be true.
This is why James is one of the best in the game. He's just special in many ways. Interesting. Great. And explain a little more, what does the current Warmly do? Like, what are you actually, what's the software that people all of a sudden finally wanted to use? And by the way, like as a quick interlude before you do that, it's very interesting. Like you can get your friends to like use almost everything, like for a little bit, right? But you immediately notice, even if you know them well, like what really excites them. And when like you just notice, even with like previous contacts, what actually sticks and what doesn't. There's like a fundamental difference. And sometimes the software has to be completely different. Sometimes it's just like little tweaks. It really depends. But it's usually very obvious, especially if you've like pivoted quite a number of times or like launched a lot of different products, what actually seems to be working and what doesn't. But it's very difficult to see it if you don't have the experience yet, right? This is something you mentioned as well.
Totally.
But
yeah.
So what does Warmly do right now?
Well, I'll get into what we do in a second. I think I just wanted to mention really fast that one of the things that I coach founders on, early stage founders, is, because I do a lot of sales and marketing stuff, is that while your first 10 customers can be warm introductions to people in your investor's network or your network to kind of just get some testers, you have not even close to approved repeatable market motion until you can get cold sales. And it's funny because I'm literally a warm leads company, but I don't think you earn the right to have warm leads and warm introduction leads until you're able to cold email, cold call, or cold LinkedIn message and get maybe 10 customers. Because you need to find somebody who doesn't give a shit about you. I mean, you know, Mike, you're a friend. If you were to message me anytime I want Warmly to use my new product, I'd say yes as a favor to you. And I probably wouldn't stick around. I probably wouldn't buy unless it was like actually valuable, but maybe I would. But to reach out cold, I mean, to someone you don't know and get them to be like, that you've broken through the noise, your value prop is so legit that I'm down to actually pay for this thing, that's gold, even if you had to fight for it. And so, yeah, get your first 10 customers through warm introductions, but get your next 10 through completely cold sales. And only once you've done that, go back to a kind of founder-led sales motion of warm leads, et cetera. So that's what I coach founders.
And yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah. This is what really shows that you've built something that people actually want using, right?
Yeah.
Build something people want. Helpful if people don't know you and not your cousins or your good friends or whatever.
Right. And all that being said, once you are ready for warm leads instead of cold leads because they convert at a higher rate, you can use Warmly. And what we do today, which is an evolution of what we built on the last couple of years, but essentially we find you warm leads that are exhibiting signals that they're in the market to buy. They may have searched for a competitor. They may have posted on LinkedIn about a problem they're facing related to what you do. They may have visited your website. They may have compared you versus another tool on a G2 crowd. So they're exhibiting these signals. They might be ready to buy. And then we help you automatically segment those into hot, warm, and cold leads, and then retarget them at scale. So for your hot leads, we let you automatically across all your sales team message them on LinkedIn, email them, and then give you their phone number so you can call them in immediately. Those are the hot ones. You have to go after them right away in real time, the next hour, otherwise you're going to lose them. For the warm leads, we help our customers reach out by ads so they can retarget them on ads, and by email so they can say, hey, listen, you might not be ready to buy just yet, but here's more information about us. Because the more touch points you put in front of that prospect, the more likely they are to finally be willing to take a demo with you. And by the way, we just work for B2B companies. And then finally, for your cold leads, we give you two options. One, we help you ignore them. Because one of the biggest costs to a sales team in terms of making revenue is working deals that are never going to convert in the first place. So we can help you ignore them. Or we can use an AI chatbot or an AI system to engage those leads and warm them up, maybe also push them to ads, you know, saying who you are until they're finally ready to buy.
Yeah, I think you said something that is also very difficult to gauge, especially at the beginning, like who will actually convert and who won't, right?
Yeah.
Because initially, as a founder, like you're just very excited about anyone who takes a meeting with you. And then you're like, oh my God, I just gave like 5 demos this week, et cetera.
Yep.
And then even once you scale and you have a sales team, you mentioned it, like a lot of the budget is literally wasted if they talk to people who will never convert,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah, huge amount.
having a good indication of who you should go after, I would love that. Yeah, that sounds very helpful to me.
Let me give you an example that a lot of our European customers use with us. Obviously, because of privacy regulation, we have to be careful with website de-anonymization, which is where we take your anonymous website traffic and resolve it to who might be on your site. Thanks to, you know, being GDPR compliant, of course, we can still actually get you the name of the company who has visited your site, which is going to be very valuable in a B2B perspective. And we can then find people at that company who live in the same city of the person who visited your website. So we can give you the kind of most likely person who visited without guaranteeing it for security and privacy reasons. But a lot of our European customers will spend a lot of money on ads. They'll send traffic to their website. And then they'll look at the de-anonymization of those leads and they'll be like, what the hell? I spent $20,000 on Meta or on Google to send what they told me was 5,000 leads to my site. But then from those 5,000 leads, only 1% converted. What the heck? And when I look behind the scenes, I realize that a lot of my traffic is junk and I'm not actually sending my true ICP, my ideal customer persona, to my website. And so, yeah, you might be getting a lot of clicks, but all that matters is book demos and B2B. And so Warmly can help you segment your traffic by ad campaign to see which ads are performing the best, not at driving the most traffic to your website, but at driving the most ICP traffic to your website.
Hmm. Yeah, very important difference. A couple paths we could follow. One that I would like to start with is how does, like, you already mentioned, like, get some customers to, like, warm introductions, then try some cold, but like how does like sales evolve over time? Because right now when you're doing like 5 million ARR, even at a company that is very good like sales and marketing,
yep,
well, you can use your own tool, right, to start and then like beyond that, how does it evolve over time, right? Like I think one of the breaking points is always like switching from like founder-led sales to employee-led sales, but are there any other like important like shifts that you've gone through? Maybe let's start with the first and then like work ourselves upwards.
Well, for founders listening in, my favorite piece that I've written 2 pieces for Kyle Poyar's Growth Unhinged. And maybe you can include these in the show notes. But the first piece is called 0 to 100 Paying Customers, How I Moved from Founder-Led Sales to Seller-Led Sales. And then the piece, the part 2 is 100 to 300 paying customers, how I moved from sales-led sales to marketing-led sales, sort of my next evolution. And I break down quarter by quarter every tool that I used and the hypotheses and questions that I asked and answered to be able to grow in the next phase of the company. So I think that can be valuable for founders out there. Once you start to hit 5 million in ARR, I think you realize that the only way to scale exponentially to continue a growth path of like 10% month-over-month growth is to unlock a series of marketing channels and build a great marketing org. I've been mostly sales-led. And I, again, caveats here are I'm mid-market, mid-ACV, B2B SaaS, kind of like down the middle. So we have both an inbound and an outbound motion, meaning we have both a sales and a marketing team. So there's other caveats and types of businesses where it makes sense to only do sales or only do marketing. We're one of those that's a mix org. But we need to lean heavier on our marketing org than ever before because I don't think I can reach 10 million in ARR in the speed that I want to unless I unlock exponential growth from my marketing team, which means finding an unfair distribution advantage. And so one of the big shifts that I've seen across our customer base that I think is actually really empowering marketers is that marketing is taking over and owning all of top of funnel. So marketing owns finding the leads and getting them to book a demo, and then sales owns from first demo to close. It used to be that SDR teams, which are a different way to generate pipeline through an outbound sales motion, would be reporting up to sales teams. And the reason that was the case is because those junior salespeople would be the future account executives for the business. And so you'd want to train them in-house near the sales executives so that they can transfer into that skill set. But as we've seen the rise of the career SDR, as well as a realignment in terms of where pipeline is actually driven, it's really cool to watch a lot of SDR orgs now report into marketing. And then that way, marketing can have a more objective, unified view of their entire pipeline and be responsible for bringing that number up over time. So more nuance there, but I would say that's a big shift that is driving more success within newer orgs.
Yeah, it also seems easier if like the orgs just own specific KPIs, right? Then you know who to blame or who to tell that they have done a good job. Otherwise, they're like, I've seen a lot of like, not necessarily conflict, but disagreements in terms of, oh, like these leads are actually like provided by marketing and then the SDRs will disagree, et cetera. So that seems like a very interesting realignment to me. One of the other things that I assume you are talking about a lot, if I talk about marketing or sales to my tech and founder friends, one of the things that inevitably comes up is the rise of all the AI marketing tools, AI SDRs, etc. On the sales side, I haven't really seen anything like work super well on that front. But maybe tell us a little more about like this. I assume the tools are changing that people are using. That's just my assumption. That's like at least true for me. How quick are they changing? And what are you seeing is different now than maybe like a year or two ago?
Yeah. So first off, it used to be back in the day that you try a piece of software. If it doesn't work, you'd never come back because you were so annoyed. But these days, with the speed of shipping and adjustments of modern products, especially AI products, as well as the speed of improvements in the models, I wouldn't write off tools that you tried once and didn't work out. I'd be open to recommend that you reevaluate those tools on every 6-month basis. Even Warmly ourselves tried an AI SDR tool, didn't work for us, and now we're trying again 8 months later. So in general, with the state of sales and marketing technology is that a lot of these agents don't actually work yet. There are like the kind of building blocks that have led us to this era are we now have a lot of easy to access contact data. We have a lot of easy to access workflow automation software and API integrators that allow us to connect tools together very seamlessly and match those with the data. Because at the end of the day, sales marketing is a game of take data, make the data hear about you, turn the people who hear about you into meetings, which turn into sales. And so while we have a lot of these tools in place now, I think slapping an AI agent on top to like do it for you is a fine V1, but is not going to win in the long term until either the model gets 1,000 times better, or you add more clever wrappers and use cases on top of how AI is interacting with your kind of like dumb software. All that is to say, I think that the AI SDR companies, the AI marketing companies, agent companies, they're getting there, but they're not perfect yet. And we Warmly, actually, as we've been building out our sales and marketing agents, are focusing first and foremost on one particular area that we think is going to be very, very valuable and useful, which is lead scoring. We think that the AI marketing agents are ready for that due to like back weighting and kind of regression testing and like other analysis that actually like really does shift around a sort of very technical problem of which leads to go after. And I do think that with the models catching up, we're going to find that in a couple of months, I don't know, let's just call it by Jan 1st, 2026, these agents will be good enough to solve real human tasks. And thus, you'll find more success in it from a sales and marketing perspective. And then big disclaimer, everything's getting more crowded. Everybody's discovering, you know, sequencers and everyone's discovering phone calls and stuff. And so there is a general decline in reply rate across the board, regardless of what organization or what AI software you use.
Yeah, I am very interested to see what the world looks like a few years from now, specifically in this space. I mean, obviously, like so many things will change, right? We could do another podcast series just about how the world looks like 5 years from now. But specifically in like, I just can't imagine that like cold outbound and the way you reach people doesn't fundamentally change because I don't know about your inbox, but like my inbox is already like, even though I have some like decent filters in there.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot of noise in there.
Let me check my phone for a number of calls today. I've had 8 spam risk calls from, you know, I don't know, random people trying to sell me stuff today. And I just like don't answer calls from anybody because I don't know a number.
Same. Like I just stopped answering any single number, which is sometimes very inconvenient if like anyone who actually needs to reach you wants to reach you. But basically whenever I talk to anyone, whether it's like a new dentist or someone who actually like tries calling me, I always tell them, please, please, please put it in the notes in like caps and bolded, send me an email, even a text potentially, but I will not answer my phone. And actually, surprisingly enough, in 50% of cases, it actually works. And they sent me like actual emails. So that's like a general life tip if you want to still talk to like your dentist or whoever. Getting back to sales and marketing from general life advice, I think one of the other things that becomes very interesting now that like things are moving very fast in all kinds of different areas and software, like there's always all this talk about software commoditizing, right? Mm-hmm. So there is some degree of truth to that because you can just ship that much faster, right? So how are you thinking about positioning yourself for the future in terms of ensuring that you have some degree of defensibility, not even against your competitors necessarily, but against like new entrants overall?
I don't believe in defensibility. I actually think it's like sort of a really fucking annoying word that VCs throw around all the time to get you to try to make some bullshit up. There is no defensibility. It's all about speed of shipping and a delightful brand. And so I think if you have the best brand, like kind of like think about like luxury goods, right? Like let's take like handbags, you know, there's going to be exact same material, exact same leather handbags for $40, or there's going to be like the Gucci handbag. And maybe Gucci doesn't make handbags. I don't know, like luxury brands, but assuming they do, you know, the Gucci brand means luxury and high class and high status. And so you want to associate yourself with that. And so that's kind of a shitty workaround answer to the core of it, which is just, I don't believe in defensibility or moats, and I don't try to build one. I just try to build as fast as I can and be smarter than other people and hope for the best.
Yeah. Throwback to one of James, your board member's article, where he talks about speed being like one of the like only advantages that you can have.
Mm-hmm.
I think he still believes in defensibility to some degree, at least in network effects, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But beyond that, I agree. Like speed is the best way to like make sure that the company actually keeps going. Let's talk about speed a little bit. How do you ensure speed at the company, and how did it change once you actually scale up to more employees, more revenue, more things that actually become more complex?
Yeah. As a first-time founder, I think you try to lead in the beginning by just doing more than everybody else. You try to like kind of lead by example. And I think it comes from a noble place, but I think it's fundamentally a bad way to lead. And I think over the last couple of years, I've been more of a people manager and then a manager of managers, is that I've seen that leading by example robs your employees of the ability to get credit for and be proud of their work. And so the relationship between a manager and their reports should very much be, here's some problems that I'm facing. Can you solve them for me? And that's not burdensome, right? It's not saying like, oh, you better solve them or you're fired. It's honestly like an inspirational thing of like, I'm struggling. You have the power to be the hero and surprise me and really crush it on this project. But you're not doing that. So get shit together. Right? And so, yeah, I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but that's a bit about how I think about it.
I think it does. Basically, what you're saying is you empower people to just become the best versions of themselves and just like solve the problems autonomously. And that automatically also increases speed because you don't have to like micromanage or anything. And if you hire the right people, that's just an assumption that I'm making, then they are better at you at their actual jobs, right? Yep. So at least that would be very helpful.
One other speed up that we found valuable is that I've heard a lot of founder friends doing this. We're tossing away our entire code base and rebuilding the whole thing from the ground up using AI. And we're going to go slower at first, but the idea is that we want to set the baseline for us to be able to code on top of it in a much more easy way using AI. And right now, our old human code base is written by humans for humans. And so I think rebuilding it will give us the kind of like flexibility that we need to be able to build the right things.
Yeah, that is a debate I've had, was a part of a couple of times in the last few weeks. And there's very strong proponents of both sides. So let's put it like that. One other very interesting thing that I definitely wanted to talk about is your whole LinkedIn persona. And everything that you're doing on there. It was actually one of the main things that I wrote down for the conversation right here.
Yeah.
How, like, tell us a little bit more about how you use your own LinkedIn profile to your own advantage. Because I think it's probably one of the best examples that I've seen out there.
Thank you. 40% of warm lead sales originate on LinkedIn. I can't drive a direct attribution specifically to my profile, other than like a little bit. So with some noise, I think I'm probably driving more than our other subject matter experts. But we do put time, money, effort, and energy behind myself, our head of revenue, Keegan, and our sales manager, Melissa. And then we also ask the long tail of SDRs to be posting, commenting, and doing stuff every day. And so we built kind of a corporate LinkedIn strategy right now, which is to essentially have all the warriors in the company, all the, like, every employee, post something every day that has to do with Warmly just to get more reach. And then there's a series of other tactics and tips that I don't have to get too far into. But as a high level, like, I hired a LinkedIn coach for a couple months. I wrote a GPT bot that looked at all the posts of my competitors and like people that I admire and want to write like, and use it to kind of draft posts for me. And then what else do I do on LinkedIn? Oh, I just use some like automations and stuff to help me manage my LinkedIn inbox to help move faster.
How do you differentiate between what actually drives more engagement and what just like feels like it's noisy to people because you post so much, right? The thing is, like, to give you credit, I think you probably have like one of the like highest quality, like in terms of like average posts that I've seen around. But I assume, is it just like increasing the quality barrier, or what are you doing to make sure that people are not getting annoyed and, oh, it's like Max again on LinkedIn?
Yeah. Vulnerability and honesty is an important one. Admitting failure is another one. And I was going to say like people believing in me, but it's sort of like, it's more phrased as like, we keep our story about being the underdog against a Goliath. And I think people care about helping the little guy. And that's how I want to be perceived until we pass $0.06 in terms of revenue.
I just want to say at some point you have to change that strategy once you actually surpass them. But yeah, you've had some interesting posts regarding to that. And you seem to be in a space where the Goliath is also not like that well liked, which is usually...
Yeah.
Which That's is awesome. Helpful because in some other spaces, you couldn't do it as easy. Let's use Stripe as an example. I'm a little biased, but I think many people like Stripe, right? So there, it would be like a little more difficult to like do what you're doing. But you found it like a good way, I think. Does your alter ego still exist on LinkedIn?
Yeah. So for those listening, I have an alter ego named Minimus Bluewald. And my name, at least on LinkedIn, is Maximus Greenwald. So we're utter nemeses. Opposite sides of the spectrum. He does cold, I do warm. And we use him as a bit or a foil to kind of express to customers why going with a warm lead database will be better for them in the long run.
Yeah, honestly, I think that was one of the hardest laughs I've had on LinkedIn because LinkedIn is usually not that humorous, right? So
yeah,
like that
well,
one's, I still remember seeing that for the first time. I had a great time. A little bit of a segue. Do you still remember where we met in person for the first time?
We met in Palo Alto on my way to my YC interview, and you posted on Twitter that you were open to giving YC mock founder coaching sessions for anyone who reached out to you, and I reached out to you that way.
Exactly. And then we met in like the building facility where I like lived at that point. Like not only lived, but it was also our office, and it was on top of the swimming pool. Like we had like this office area, and I met you and the rest of the crew. So
that's so great.
I will always remember that very fondly because it was like a very intense time. It was like right after our YC batch.
Oh wow. I mean, you must have probably did you interview like 20 or 30 startups that week?
I did so many mock interviews back then.
Wow.
Yeah. I still do quite a number of YC mock interviews. Nowadays it's like not that many more. I had a phase where I did like 15 on a Sunday, where like most of my Sundays like back to back like scheduled. Usually now it's like friends of friends reaching out or people who like read some of the content that I wrote about it.
Yeah.
But I always like it because I meet some great people through it. Like you're the best example of that, right?
Well, I appreciate that. I honestly, like so many of my friends in life have come from my founder journey that one of the best ways and reasons to start a company is just to make new friends.
Like it's the same for me. I'm very biased to that. But like some of my really good new friends have been other founders, people who I've met through the whole journey. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about it is also if you have other people who like understand you on like a deeper level, right? That makes it easier to trust yourself and just be vulnerable and like build friendships a bit more quickly just because you don't have to like bridge this gap that sometimes exists if someone like doesn't understand the founder journey that well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, totally agree with that. Maybe like two or three more questions in the interest of time. One of the things that I want to get back to is like now you're going to San Francisco, you're gearing up for the next stage of the company. What are you most anxious about when it comes to like the next stages? Do you have anything that you are like that keeps you up at night or something that's like your main worry?
I mean, my goal probably the next worry is or next milestone is to raise our Series B. So that'd be kind of like a worry, I guess, in a way. But the real thing is I'm just having this sinking feeling about AI taking over the world that I think a lot of us are having, which is like, if this thing's moving that fast in a year, what's to say, you know, what it's going to do in like 2 years? And I guess I want to be clear that Wormly is a place where we hire humans, you know, and like we want to basically bring in a consultative approach and high value customer success managers to leverage and use our AI solutions. But yeah, I think what's keeping me up at night is the confusion around, are we going to see the rapid collapse of large teams and big companies, because you'll have a lot of nimble, speedy teams that are moving way faster and building up different products. So that would be one concern I have.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. And there's so many areas to be worried about when it comes to AI, right? I'm also extremely mm-hmm. excited about it. So it's like, it's basically a pendulum that swings depending on the day. I assume it's the same for you.
I think the exact same, man. It's AI nihilism, the world's going to end, and then AI think boy, which is like, oh my God, this is the best, coolest thing ever. It's the best time to build. It is the best time to build. It's just hard to know what's going to really work.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And this is also why speed becomes even more important, right? Mm. Because it always felt like startups had to move faster than big companies. But with LLM specifically as an enabling technology, the giants understood very quickly that they need to adopt this. This wasn't the classic disruption, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Like this
it wasn't
was
like some... it wasn't like, oh, it's not going to happen. It's not going to affect me.
Exactly. Like big companies understood very quickly, have a distribution advantage, and like throw a lot of money at very smart engineers, as we've seen recently, and researchers, obviously, like if you're on the foundation mod level. But so basically, like everyone tries to move faster. And this is like the first time where I really understood like the generation that came before us, that grew up without the internet, that always told me how much faster things seem to be moving, like around the like new millennia and like the internet, like really like expanding and then mobile coming. For us, like it was just like normal and like part of like life. But now with AI, it feels like it almost feels like things are moving so fast that it's like impossible to like keep up with everything.
Yep.
Because like back then, meaning like 3 years ago, right? Or like 4 years ago. Like if
back in my day,
yeah. Like if things, like if new developments came out, then like most people knew about the next big thing. But nowadays there's so many new models, new applications, new things being launched that it's almost impossible to keep up with everything, which is exciting because it means there's a lot of hopefully good innovation happening. But it's also just you need new, I think what I want to actually get across is you need new systems to survive in this new world, just because the old way of working doesn't work that well anymore.
I completely agree.
And then like, I think two things that I usually like to do during the end is there any specific like book, piece of content, anything that has informed your way of how you build companies? Anything, it can be literally anything. It can be like a quote, can be a book, can be a blog post, anything that you would attribute some of your founder philosophy to.
I really like Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies by Jim Collins. I think it taught me a lot about management.
Nice. That's a good one. And then one of the other things I always like to do is there any question that I haven't asked that you think is like really important to understand who you are as like a founder, what Wormly really encompasses? Is there anything that you would like to add?
Maybe something in the realm of how do I divide and conquer the world with my co-founders?
That's a good one. Let's do that.
So I think that 4 co-founders is too many. We had co-founders at the start and now we're only 3. But 2 or 3, I think, is the right call.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that we've been able to divide up responsibilities less around department and title, because we all have the co-founder title. So like my other co-founders just don't care about it. And more around what's going to move the business needle the fastest. And in doing that process and kind of back and forth and just figuring out, okay, like Karina, like you want to do customer success this quarter? Alan, do you want to do marketing this quarter? Alan, do you want to do product this quarter? I mean, we've tried every different role for these other 2 co-founders and they've done a great job of all of it as we like need new kind of levels of scale and everything breaks. But I think that what it teaches you is ultra fast context switching. I think it shows you problems across the org that only you can uniquely solve. And it's just such a good example of low ego work, which is like my co-founders and I are not in it for the money. We do the same thing if it was free. And we just want to be really, really good and meticulous. And so tossing a co-founder into a department has been excellent for our mental health as a trio, but also for the mental health or the outcomes, I guess, maybe more importantly, of the actual teams are being dropped into. And I feel very grateful that I can kind of toss my co-founders around to different parts of the org.
That is very helpful indeed. And I think one of the cool things about like switching things around as well is, A, it gives you more context about the overall org, right? So higher level conversations that you have about the direction will be more informed, because usually what happens, and that's I think how most companies still operate, is everyone has their own silo where they know everything and the co-founders maybe know a little bit. But like this, you have a little more cross-functional knowledge and maybe more understanding of what actually works and doesn't work. So it sounds very challenging. And I don't think every company can just repeat the same thing, because you need the right kind of people for that to actually work, is my assumption. But if you have it and it can work, that sounds very powerful.
We are lucky there for sure. We have a weekly co-founder sync just to kind of check in with stuff. And we bring a leadership coach to it as well to make sure there's no kind of like tension between the three of us.
Nice.
But it was something we lucked into for sure. Because actually, I didn't really know Alan before starting the company. I knew Karina because we worked together at Google, but it was kind of a guess otherwise.
Well, then you apparently made a good guess. And I think that's a good way to close it off. Thank you so much for all your time. Thanks for the insight. And if people want to find you on LinkedIn, it's Maximus Greenwald. We just talked about that. Company's called Warmly. And I hope you have a good rest of your week.
Thank you. See you, Mike.